Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
And we want to get right to breaking news today out of Ottawa, Canada, where Parliament is on lockdown as police there respond to a shooting or shootings in and around the Parliament building. A Globe and Mail recording captured some of the gunfire and images of people running inside the halls of Parliament. There have also been eyewitness accounts coming out. Ontario lawmaker Charlie Angus told the CBC how the shooting unfolded.
Suddenly there was a whole series of gunfire that sounded like it was right outside the door. People got under tables, under chairs. We tried to make sure everybody was safe, tried to block the doors, but those doors didn't seem very, doesn't feel like it'll do much. Security came in very quickly, which I was surprised. I thought we'd be lying there for some time and said, we're getting you out. We're getting you out now.
And this situation continues to unfold, and it comes just 2 days after two Canadian soldiers were run over, one of them killed in Quebec by a suspected jihadist. Joining us now from Ottawa is James Fitzmaurice, senior reporter with the CBC. And James, you are yourself on lockdown near the Parliament. Tell us what the latest is.
That's right. Our offices here are just about two or three blocks from Parliament, and everyone's who has a desk near the windows has been moved away. We've blocked up our windows with anything we can find because basically we don't know how many shooters there are involved in this. There are at least two, possibly three. We've had shootings in three different locations. The first one this morning at the War Memorial, just about two blocks from Parliament Hill, and then the shooter there ran towards Parliament Hill, actually carjacked a vehicle on the hill. Now, the only vehicles allowed on hills are the cars of ministers, really. So it is likely someone who's a member of cabinet whose car was hijacked. The shooter then brought the car up to the main doors of the Parliament buildings, ran inside, and as you mentioned earlier, got into a shootout with security inside, well inside the Parliament buildings. And we have heard that that person is dead. But clearly, the entire downtown core still in lockdown here as police hunt for at least one other shooter, possibly two more.
And we're hearing also about a possible shooting at a mall near Parliament. This is what the AP is reporting.
That's correct. Basically, you know, the War Memorial, Parliament is to the left of it. To the right of it is a large shopping mall. We have reports of a shot fired, or shots fired, I should say, in there. We're still trying to sort that out. We actually have reporters near there who don't see anything going on their side of the building. But what's of note is that actually almost attached to this building, just next to it, is a large office tower that is the home of the headquarters for the National Defense Department. So obviously concerned that that would also be a potential target.
Do we know more about the gunman who has reportedly been killed inside the Parliament building?
No, we have just a description of in very general terms that he was a tall man wearing jeans and a white top, had a scarf over his head of some sort. And apparently, there's a small ceremony that takes place daily, a ritual changing of the guards at the War Memorial. The shooter, according to witness reports, was carrying some sort of long rifle and just walked up to one of the soldiers that was partaking in this ceremony and shot them in the chest. Hmm. Then, as I said, fled on foot and got into the Parliament buildings. Now, what we're trying to sort out as well is that there are, as I say, reports of the shots being fired next to that. There's also police that are reporters who are trapped outside of our building at the moment because we are locked down, are being told to just take cover anywhere they can because they're worried there might be shooters actually on the roofs of some buildings.
And we hear that military bases around the country are on lockdown as well. Tell us more about the response outside of Ottawa.
That's right. Well, certainly, as also you mentioned, given the incident just a few days ago in Montreal with two armed forces personnel being run down by someone while they're walking along near a strip mall, and then a soldier again being targeted this morning while in uniform, while the police certainly don't know yet if this is related to ISIS activity or Canada's participation in the military action there, they are certainly treating it that way. As you mentioned, beyond the lockdown here, it has stretched to other military military bases around the country. We're not exactly sure if it's all of them yet. We're having some bases tell us that they have not changed their operational parameters at the moment, but certainly some of them have been put on heightened alert and are barring any traffic going to or leaving those bases.
Has there been any comment yet from Prime Minister Harper?
No, there was a quick message saying that he is safe. Of course, and also we've understood that the area where his official residence is, which is about 2 kilometers, a little over a mile away, that those streets have been closed. They're barring all traffic from heading into that area. So his office also is just across. He has one office in Parliament Hill, another across the street from there. We're not sure where he was during this incident, but we understand that he's safe, and there's been no comment yet from his office other than that.
All right, an unfolding story there in Ottawa, Canada, and we'll continue to follow it. The CBC's James Fitzmaurice joining us from his office where he is on lockdown near the Parliament in Canada. James, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll, of course, continue to follow this story, but we want to turn now to China and the fight against corruption there. When Chinese President Xi Jinping came to power 2 years ago, he said his number one goal was to clean up politics. He launched an anti-corruption campaign, the likes of which the communist state has never seen before. Thousands of party officials now under investigation or imprisoned. And a growing number are committing suicide. The BBC's China editor Carrie Grace reports.
Two ashen-faced men stumbling into the dock. Cut to grim court officials pronouncing their fate. China's daily news broadcasts have become a roll call of communist shame. A parade of officials tried for taking bribes on a massive scale. The Communist Party's slogan is "Serve the people." But everyone in China knows it's often the other way around. When President Xi Jinping took charge 2 years ago, he started jailing corrupt officials. Now they're all scared. 51-year-old government official Dong Xuegang got out of the lift here on the 9th floor of his apartment block on the night of 13th of September. He'd just been interrogated as part of a corruption investigation into his boss. 12 hours later, he climbed from his bedroom window and jumped to his death. An elderly neighbour tells me Mr. Dong landed on a car parked below. It must have been a horrifying scene. But now all is tranquil in this leafy lakeside compound.
He panicked.
The assessment of Gao Qinrong, the investigative journalist who broke the story of Dong Xuegang's suicide jump.
You'd think death would be a more frightening prospect, but these officials are terrified of losing their fortune and their reputation. And they're also worried that they may be made to inform on others. They just can't face living through all of that. They prefer to end it all quickly.
I'm standing in front of a Shanxi prison. But that's not the prison yard you're hearing. That's the teenagers in the school opposite going through their morning exercise routine. The prison is silent. Deep inside are 60 party officials serving time for corruption, living out the life of shame that Dong Xuegang chose not to. A local real estate developer shows me around town in his chauffeur-driven limousine. He doesn't want me to name him, and as we drive through concrete canyons of high-rise construction, the reason becomes obvious. Every single project, he says, his own included, has involved bribing officials.
The only difference is scale. Some are more corrupt, some are less, but they are all corrupt. And so are all the business people who have to deal with them. It's normal practice to give gifts. If you don't, your projects won't go through.
But now the anti-corruption campaign has paralyzed government here. No one knows how to get things done. The campaign has many skeptics and critics. But Professor Wang Yukai of the Chinese Academy of Governance says they would be wrong to underestimate Xi Jinping.
No one should doubt his resolution. He's targeted even top leaders. It's unprecedented under communist rule. It's a shockwave through the system. And Xi Jinping has enormous public support as a result.
In this part of China, ancient shadow puppets hold the imagination of a theatre audience. On this stage, a puppet hero battling a puppet tiger. Xi Jinping calls his own corruption battle a life and death tiger fight. But for every tiger he slays, there's another in the wings. And a ruling party which hasn't yet worked out how to function without its bribery fix.
That report from the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie.
And before we go to break, a note about something that happened today in Hong Kong. The smooth jazz musician Kenny G paid a visit to the Hong Kong protesters who are demanding free and fair elections. And that is causing a stir. After Kenny G's visit today, a spokesperson for the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs said Kenny G's musical works are widely popular in China, but China's position on the illegal Occupy Central activities in Hong Kong is very clear. We hope that foreign governments and individuals speak and act cautiously and not support Occupy Central. But there are others who think Kenny G's visit is an attempt to get the protesters to leave. That's because Kenny G's 1989 song Going Home is played in public spaces in China, like shopping malls, when they are about to close, has been for decades. One protester told the New York Times, "We didn't leave when the police used tear gas on us. Why would a single Kenny G tune shake our determination?" This is Here and Now. Less than 2 weeks to go until the midterm elections. Let's get to our Senate tracker and a state this week that has a very tight race going on, Iowa. Longtime Democratic Senator Tom Harkin is retiring from his seat, and Republican State Senator Joni Ernst and Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley are vying for that spot. Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio joins us from Des Moines with more on this. Clay, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And this is a state that knows its politics very well. Of course, every 4 years, it's the first in the nation caucus state during the presidential race. Does this feel like that? Is the politics that hot, or is this not quite to that level?
No, it's a real rare thing that a Senate seat opens up like this. So we've been talking about this race for more than a year, and it's just been getting more and more outside money poured into it. And really, the rhetoric and the campaign ads, it's just been nonstop.
And let's hear about the candidates. And first, Republican State Senator Joni Ernst. Here she is speaking at last week's debate in Sioux City.
I will fight hard for middle-class families so they have better-paying jobs. I will work for the thousands of Iowans who are facing higher health care costs because of Obamacare. And I will protect Social Security and Medicare for our seniors because they have sacrificed so much that our families can reach for the American dream.
You know, in all of the Senate trackers that we've done, Clay, I don't think I've heard a single candidate not mention Obamacare if they're the Republican candidate. Tell us more about Joni Ernst and what she's campaigning on.
Yeah, a year ago, Joni Ernst was still pretty unknown to the vast majority of Iowans. I remember us reporters were not even sure who the Republican candidate was going to be a year ago. She was in a crowded primary race. And as long as she's been in the Iowa Senate, she's been in the minority party. And she's from Red Oak, a small town in southwest Iowa. Now, unlike Congressman Braley, she had a very competitive primary, which she won, earning a lot of the so-called Republican establishment, as well as picking up some Tea Party voters. She had Sarah Palin was here ahead of the primary. And in the primary, she really had some slick ads that really caught attention. There was one about how growing up on an Iowa farm, castrating hogs made her a good candidate so she could go cut pork in Washington. Another one showed her wearing a leather jacket, driving a Harley to a shooting range, and pointing a gun at the camera and saying she would take dead aim on Obamacare.
Wow.
And she's a very polished candidate, and the cameras seem to love her.
Okay, well, she is running against Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley. Let's take a listen to Congressman Braley.
As your next senator, I'm going to get up every morning thinking about what I can do to make your lives better. And I'm going to focus on economic policies that are going to strengthen the middle class, because that's what Iowans have always depended upon, whether it's in agriculture, in education, in energy.
What should we know about Congressman Braley?
Well, he is a four-term congressman from northeast Iowa, a lawyer from Waterloo, that's a city up there in northeast Iowa, and he has an interesting number of endorsements from around the state. The Iowa corn growers endorsed him, while they also endorsed a lot of Republicans in other races, which is makes it an interesting endorsement, including they endorsed Steve King, the firebrand that many people know up in northwest Iowa's very conservative 4th district. Over the weekend, Cedar Rapids Gazette, the newspaper out in eastern Iowa, endorsed him as well, saying it's important to keep a balance among Iowa's United States senators in that the state has had one of each party for more than 30 years, really. Republican Chuck Grassley has been there a long time, serving with Democrat Tom Harkin. And there's also been a lot of people in the state throwing their support, prominent Democrats like Hillary Clinton. Senator Elizabeth Warren was just here. And the First Lady is making a couple stops here as well.
And by the way, Senator Grassley is still quite popular in Iowa, right?
Yeah, he's very popular, and he has said he's seeking re-election, which at 81 years old, and he keeps getting re-elected, I'd say that's popularity right there.
So we've heard there from the candidates talking about health care and the economy. What are the main issues for voters?
Well, what you're really seeing is a war of personalities taking place. The Ernst campaign is really trying to paint Braley as out of touch with Iowans, mainly connecting him to comments he made early on in the race before the general election to a group of lawyer donors in Texas. Now, we were just talking about Republican Chuck Grassley, who's pretty popular in the state. He made a comment about Grassley being a farmer from Iowa who does not have a law degree, making him unfit to chair the Judiciary Committee should Republicans take control over the Senate. Now, on the flip side of that, the Braley campaign is working to paint Ernst as an extremist. During the primary, she said she does not believe in a federal minimum wage. That's been a big issue for them, as well as comments she made about privatizing Social Security being an option on the table. And outside money is really trying to capitalize on all of these things.
And what are the polls saying?
The polls are still showing that it's too close to call. Ernst's been ahead by just a couple points in the last few polls, but again, much too close to call.
Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio speaking with us about the very close Senate race there between State Senator, the Republican Joni Ernst, and Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley. They are vying for the seat that's been held for a long time by Democratic Senator Tom Harkin. We'll be watching. Clay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jeremy.
Well, there is news today that directly affects the wallets of 70 million Americans. Social Security will increase payments by 1.7% next year. That comes to about $20 a month for the average Social Security recipient. Let's get context from Diane Swank, senior economist for Mesirow Financial in Chicago. And Diane, by law, the payments have to be adjusted every year. Costs are compared, and then the adjustment happens. So explain more how it works.
Well, the cost of living index, the CPI, is not really the best index of cost of living. There's better measures out there, but it is the one we use for contracts, and it's done by a fixed basket of goods that they adjust over time. They quality adjust things like the quality of your car so that if you pay more in price but you're getting more quality, it doesn't show up as an increase in price. So it's got a lot of aspects to it, and the overall index is an average of all these prices weighted by a basket of goods.
Well, so put this 1.7% increase in context. How is that seen?
Well, the important issue for the 1.7% for the 70 million Americans that are going to be getting this is that they don't spend the average of the basket. They spend more disproportionately on things like prescription drugs that are going up much more rapidly than the overall. They spend more on shelter and food, which are also going up more rapidly. And so they're paying higher inflation but getting less compensation for it because they don't get the benefits of things like plummeting prices at the pump because they're not driving to work, to and from work every day. A lot of these are retirees. So
yeah.
The mix is just not the best mix for really compensating people for what they're actually spending on.
And this is, we understand, the third year in a row that this adjustment has been below 2%. So again, using that basket, it's not being increased the way it was when things in those baskets were really inflated.
Exactly. And, you know, it really is important on what is rising and what isn't. And for these people in particular, the things that they face as inflationary costs are going up much more rapidly than the average. And also what we miss in all this is the difficult trade-offs that are made when things like meat, poultry, proteins, dairy products at the store go up in price. These people are forced to make very difficult trade-offs to buy cheaper kinds of, you know, pasta, rice, less vegetables, and compromise their diets as well.
Diane Swank, senior economist for the Mesirow Financial, speaking with us from Chicago. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
The official St. Louis County autopsy of Ferguson teen Michael Brown was obtained by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. Forensic experts tell the paper the report shows Brown was shot in the hand at close range, had been using marijuana, and was not holding his arms up in a typical surrender position, as some witnesses said. Christine Byers is a crimes reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's with us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And let's start with the hand wound. Darren Wilson, the Ferguson police officer who shot Brown, told investigators that Brown was reaching for his gun inside the car, the police officer's gun. So what do forensic experts tell you this autopsy says about that?
Well, the autopsy took some time to explain some samples taken from the hand wound itself. There was further analysis done on the particulates found on his skin. And what those findings showed, according to the autopsy, was that there was matter consistent with what would be found on the barrel of a gun. So it seems to comport with that statement that there was a struggle over the gun.
Well, that's interesting because the family, as you know, had commissioned another autopsy that they released in August. And in that report, the forensics expert said none of Michael Brown's wounds were from firing at close range. Now, you say that this report that's just come out does square with the one the family commissioned, but that would seem to be a disconnect because you can't get closer range than possibly struggling over a gun. So what do you make of that?
The autopsies, the family's autopsy and the county autopsy, are similar in some ways and conflict in some ways. And similar in that the positioning of the gunshot wounds and the amount of shots are consistent six times. What is not consistent, as you just noted, was the finding that none of the wounds were sustained at close range. Well, the family autopsy was done after this autopsy. This was the first autopsy that was done. And like I mentioned before, they excised some of the tissue from Michael Brown's hand. They removed it for further analysis. So when the body was given to the private autopsy, the telling tissue, if you will, had been removed.
Oh.
And his body also, as per protocol, after an autopsy is performed, bodies are washed.
Well, let's move to what's probably going to be the most controversial finding in the autopsy. And this is actually an interpretation of a finding in the autopsy by a forensics expert that you spoke with. The autopsy traces the trajectory of the six shots into Michael Brown. And what did the autopsy find about the sixth shot? And how did your expert interpret that?
The expert interpreted that as that it traveled from the back of Michael Brown's arm to the inner arm, which means that his palms could not have been facing Wilson, as some witnesses have said. So that, you know, further indicates, in her opinion, her medical opinion, that the trajectory supports that Brown was not taking the standard surrender position with his arms above his shoulders and palms out when he was hit, as some witnesses have described.
What do you take from this information as far as what impact it might have on Officer Darren Wilson, who, again, you know, the grand jury is still considering this case? What do you think this report shows?
Well, I think it shows that there is forensic evidence to support a struggle over the weapon. It certainly doesn't, you know, fully explain how that struggle began and what those circumstances were.
That's Christine Byers, crime reporter for the St. Louis Dispatch. Again, they obtained a copy of the official autopsy of the teenager Michael Brown, who was shot by police officer Darren Wilson. Christine, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And county officials say they will formally release the report after the grand jury considering the case adjourns.
An Indiana man that police say has confessed to killing seven women appeared for the first time in court today but refused to speak. Darren Vann is being charged with the murder of one woman at this point, 19-year-old Africa Hardy, who he allegedly met on Backpage.com and then strangled in a Motel 6 in Hammond, Indiana on Friday. But when Vann was arrested over the weekend, he reportedly told police that he'd also killed six other women. And in the last few days, police have found six bodies in abandoned houses in Gary, Indiana. Speaking at a press conference, Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson called the case a horrible thing.
It's a source of great concern. This is extraordinary. You don't get people who kill multiple folks every day.
So what is going on inside the mind of someone who does? Dr. Park Dietz is a forensic psychiatrist who's consulted or testified in many high-profile cases involving serial killers. He's with us now. And a note to listeners, we're going to be talking about some disturbing information about serial killers that may not be appropriate for young listeners. Dr. Dietz, welcome.
Thank you.
We're obviously just beginning to learn about Darren Vann, and at this point he's only being charged with one murder, but police say he's also confessed to at least six other murders. Does he fit the profile of a serial killer?
Well, you know, there is no one single profile of a serial killer. Anyone who kills three or more victims in separate incidents, or in some instances two or more, because the definition keeps changing, could be considered a serial killer. The kind that's of greatest interest to the public for a long time has been the sexual serial killers, and what he's accused of doing sounds pretty typical of that. What most people don't realize is that it doesn't take much by way of unusual features of humanity to become a sexual serial killer. It's not as if they're another species. They're drawn from a group of repetitive criminals who happen to have some peculiar sexual interests and needs.
Well, and he was a registered sex offender. So how common is that for a serial killer to also be a sex offender?
Well, some of them are. Some of them aren't convicted in the past. The difference between the average serial killer and the average sex offender is having gotten away with it long enough to rack up the body count needed to meet the definition.
Well, and I think that's the other thing that's a bit puzzling here is why does it take authorities so long to track these serial killers down? How can they get through so many murders before they're found? And then all of a sudden, when they are found, they're willing to admit to these murders.
Well, there are a couple different things they do to avoid being caught. The first thing, and it appears it may have been true in this case, is to select victims who are not going to attract a lot of attention. Somebody who abducts and kills a young blonde white girl who's pretty is going to attract a lot of attention. But someone who selects for victimization people who are very marginal in society because they're homeless or drug addicts or prostitutes is going to attract attention more slowly.
So they are specifically going after people that they think will not attract a lot of attention.
Well, it's hard to know if that's so, but there's such a high correlation between ease of access to victims and not attracting much attention that it works out that way. Maybe they're just going for the easiest targets, people they can recruit to a secluded location for 10 minutes is all it takes.
Now, you're a forensic psychiatrist. What do we know about what's going on inside the mind of a serial killer and whether they are insane or whether they are sane and know exactly what they're doing?
Well, it's very rare for them to have a psychotic illness that could qualify them for an insanity defense. There have been a few, but that's quite unusual. More typically, we're looking at people who are mad at the world, who have had a lousy life. These are not happy, well-adjusted people with some work-life balance. These tend to be quite marginal people who, if they work, hate their jobs, who, if they're married, hate their wives, who, if they're in touch with their family, hate their families, who grew up with pain and poverty and misery and neglect and abuse in many instances, and who simply don't give a damn about anyone or anything. Now, there are little exceptions to that rule. You know, once in a while, there's one who loves his dog. There are some who love the collection of trophies that they take from their victims. But basically, these are miserable people who have an unusual sexual interest, because, you know, not all miserable people do this. The unusual sexual interests that get people in this situation are finding strangulation to be the most arousing thing they can imagine, finding torture the most arousing thing they can imagine, finding a non-moving, non-resisting, non-complaining partner the most arousing thing they can imagine. Some of them are seeking a dead body for that purpose. And often this is linked with some hatred of women that's generalized from one or two women in their lives who've been so miserable to them that they deflect that anger onto other women.
And are there warning signs? Are there things that, people like you could look for in patients who may end up doing something like this, and you would know from the way that they behave that they are a potential serial killer?
Well, first of all, most of these people don't end up in therapy. If they do, it's because a court made them do it, or they are seeing a mental health professional in a jail or prison setting. It's not as if they go seek relief from their problems. But the warnings that do exist are not specific to being a serial killer. What they would share with anyone they trusted enough, who would tend to be peers rather than therapists or parents, is signs of being a psychopath who does not care about anyone else's feelings. In other words, we can see in advance the lack of conscience, the lack of morality, the aggressiveness, the irresponsibility, the recklessness. But these are traits that are very widely distributed, and hardly any of the people with those traits become serial killers. So it takes a combination of those sorts of traits most of the time and also some unusual sexual kink to even have the motivation to do a series of sexually motivated homicides. And thankfully, that's not too common. The public fear of it is much more common than the prevalence of the behavior itself.
That's Dr. Park Dietz, a forensic psychiatrist and the founder and head of the forensic consulting firm Park Dietz & Associates. Thank you so much, Dr. Dietz.
Thanks for inviting me.
And it's been called the worst movie never seen. Oh, no. The sound of a killer bed devouring a young couple. How often do I get to say that? In the movie Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. It was made in 1973 by a young filmmaker named George Barry, who couldn't sell it. Years later, he tried releasing it on video. No go. Then it was pirated in the UK, where it became a kind of cult classic with Rocky Horror Picture Show type following, which Barry found out about while trolling the internet in 2001. That's when he finally was able to release it on DVD, to the resentment of comedians like Patton Oswalt, who wondered why this film and not others.
Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People. I'm not making, go IMDb this. This is a real movie. Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People. And it's about a bed that's evil and it eats people. That's the whole movie. And the
backstory. Well, now he's really going to be ticked, because tomorrow, Deathbed will hit the stage at Big Dog's Cape Fear Playhouse Halloween Horror Theater Festival in Wilmington, North Carolina. It'll have an original script by Gwenifer Roller and help from Jacques Brandis, who worked on the original film. And Gwenifer joins us now from the studios of WHQR. Gwenifer, what made you think there would be an audience for Deathbed in Wilmington?
Well, I need to explain that Wilmington is sort of this unrecognized gem of theater in the United States. Everybody thinks about really big markets, but as a result of the film industry that started here in the early 80s, we have a tremendous theater scene with over 36 active theater companies.
So that raises the question, why would you want to ruin it by staging with,
well, Death so, Bed? Well, the answer to that is because I'm one of the theater critics.
Well, now let's back up. First of all, as a critic, tell us a little bit more, synopsize, if you will, the film.
The film the premise is that there is a demon that fell in love with this girl, built a bed to make love with her. Things didn't work out. She dies. He is now trapped in the bed, and he eats people. And the bed is at this abandoned mansion in Detroit.
It could happen.
Right. I mean, actually, as Steve, the artistic director for Big Dog, says, what is so amazing is you actually have to recline in order to be killed by the monster in this movie. Like, it can't chase you. You know, it can't do anything. You have to lie there and let it happen.
In this four-poster bed. Meanwhile, we should say one of the ghosts of one of his victims is hidden behind a painting on the wall. It's right. And a stream of people come
to the middle of nowhere to have sex on this bed. And in a weird way, it would be a great commercial for abstinence.
The filmmaker is still alive, George Barry,
yes.
Although older. How does he feel about it being made into a play?
Well, so Jack, my infinitely better half, worked on the original film. He was the guy who built the eating mechanism that made the bed eat or dissolve people and heal at the movie. And he's actually the priest that dies in the movie. And,
oh, really? By being sucked down into the bed while he's reading.
Right. Well, and it had this sort of like Ed Wood-like feel to it. It was they were going to demonstrate how the bed worked. And the response was, oh, no, we're not wasting all that Mr. Bubble and glycerin and food coloring. If you're going to show how this works, we're going to shoot it. Get him in costume.
We know that there is a box that holds the precious blob from the movie The Blob. You know, up in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, they have that festival every year. What was this tapioca-like thing that was in the bed that kills? What is that, Mr. Bubble?
It's Mr. Bubble, glycerin, and all the yellow food coloring that was available for purchase in the greater Detroit area. So we called George, and he said, let me think about it. And he called back 2 days later and said, I don't see any problem with it. I've got a couple of minor things, and one of them, which I thought was perfectly reasonable, was so act one of the play is the making of the movie. He said, I want whatever you write to be very clearly defined as fiction. This is not a documentary. I said, that's fine. He said, okay. And so George is coming for the opening, and he and Jack have not seen each other since Principal Photography wrapped in 73.
So you're going to branch out and have it be more about the making of the film.
Right. There is this wonderful thing that happens, I think, when you hit your late teens and early 20s and you realize you could actually do something. Like, you could make a movie. Mm-hmm. And that, I would say, is an easier realization to have now in an age of flip phones and YouTube than it was in 1972 when you had to rent film stock and pay for film developing. There's a magic that happens at that point in your life. And then you pursue that dream, and everything you never imagined going wrong does go wrong. You know, at one point, they're trying to smuggle a skeleton across an international border in real life, and it's in the play, Jock got thrown out of a whorehouse in Detroit trying to borrow a Gideon Bible. You know, I mean, just like an assortment of strange things.
I bet I know that why they needed the skeleton. Towards the end of the film, there's a young man who tries to stab the bed to death, and instead the bed eats his hands. And cut to the next scene, he's sitting there with two skinny little skeleton hands.
Right. There's no flesh left. It's hardly any blood. It's almost like a surgical operation.
I don't think I can stand it.
He wouldn't also be, you know, on his way to an emergency room, but he's not. He's sort
right.
of...
And it all happened so quickly. You can't imagine how quickly that flesh just dissolved. And that is actually William Russ, who you have seen most prominently as the father in American History X. That was his film debut in 1973.
Oh, you're kidding. That's Gwyneth Roller. She's talking about the film Deathbed. She's now written a play based on it. You're listening to Here and Now. So were others we'd know in the film?
Yeah, the artist trapped behind the painting is Dave Marsh, who wrote for Cream magazine. He coined the term punk rock. He was one of the founders of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. You've probably
goodness.
Interviewed him.
I have. That's wow.
It's him.
Well, but how do they all feel about it? Looks as if it became a cult classic and it's called a parody, but it looks as if they took it seriously.
I think they did. Our conversations where it really sounds like they were making Citizen Kane, and then there are conversations where they kind of get that it was kind of a Roger Corman thing.
Yeah, but you know, we can laugh, but they did it. They made
it. Oh, yes. I don't think a lot of people realize how hard that was. It's very easy to sit in the cheap seats and make fun, but it's a lot harder to actually do it. George seems to have a very pragmatic view. He says, you know, some people hate it, some people love it. When we talked, he said, you can say anything you want about it, except you can't say that I was on drugs when I made it because I wasn't, and I'm offended that people say that.
Okay. Well, and you're going to be mounting this play. How's the theater community reacting? Do you have people just banging down the door to be in Deathbed?
Well, all the designers in town are excited because you can imagine the special effects and the props and the lighting for this. Just gallons of fake blood. And an awful lot of George's dialogue from the original film is in the stage adaptation. And forgive me if I offend any of the performers in the film, but to actually hear talented actors with craft read that dialogue, it's like, wow, George was actually onto something here. And because I have watched Deathbed about 200 times between December and now. And we finally came up with a title for the play, by the way.
Oh, yeah,
the
what is it?
It's Deathbed, the Bed That Eats. So the play is Deathbed, the Play That Bites.
Oh, best of luck with it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we needed a break from the news. That's Gwenifer Roller. Her play, Deathbed, the Play That Bites, opens tomorrow at the Cape Fear Playhouse in Wilmington, North Carolina. Again, it's based on the film Deathbed. And we want to send a shout-out, Jeremy, to filmmaker George Barry. I think she's right. I think he was onto something. He did achieve his goal. He made a movie, and it has entertained a lot of people. Mm. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. We promise to try to do a story about pizza or something like that tomorrow to lighten things up. This is Here and Now.